is kicking off very, very soon, straight after my show. My name is Mick. Peace.
Like whole families, given notices to evict because they can't pay their rent, having mental health challenges, having complex health needs, and not having food and basic needs every day come in.
A report today alerts Australia to the plight of 30,000 refugees and asylum seekers accepted into the country 6 years ago, but now cut off from all support and...
With everything they've gone through, they come in as broken women, but they leave feeling amazing, and that's probably the best part of my job.
A local tattoo artist is working to give women back their self-confidence. Hello and welcome to The Wire, National Independent Current Affairs on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Oliver Brown in Adelaide. Also on The Wire today, the flu season is well and truly upon us, sparking the controversial vaccine debate once again. Stay tuned to hear these stories and more on The Wire. But first today, at the conclusion of the Banking Royal Commission in February, lead investigators recommended the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, or APRA, needed its own independent review. Months later, the three-member panel, headed by former ACCC Chairman Graham Samuel, are now calling for serious changes to the banking regulator. The panel's findings have made 24 recommendations to APRA and the federal government to improve APRA's accountability. I spoke with the founder of left-wing news site Crikey and self-described shareholder activist Stephen Mayne about his thoughts on the review's findings.
APRA's generally done a good job over the years, but clearly they've been a bit too tame, and I was a little surprised that Graham Samuel was so tough on them, effectively criticising them for being a relatively weak regulator.
In their report, the panel have actually made some recommendations, including ensuring that APRA has sufficient powers to restrict the appointment or reappointment of inappropriate leaders. What are your thoughts on the recommendations?
Well, that's a pretty bold recommendation to effectively have the government involved in vetoing senior executives and directors of major financial institutions. But that already happens in the gambling industry in Australia, and the UK have embraced a similar measure. Given that banks are so systemically important and powerful and rely on effectively on a government guarantee, I think it's quite reasonable that the government, having licensed these banks, can also effectively veto any directors they believe are not performing well.
Do you think the recommendations go far enough?
I think they're pretty strong recommendations, like urging APRA to be much tougher on superannuation and to get into the industry far more aggressively. I think that's quite an interesting move. And similarly, criticising APRA for doing far too many backroom deals and urging them to be far more of a name and shame regulator. I agree with that approach, and that APRA has not been naming and shaming nearly enough. And I think that is a rocket that APRA deserves, and let's hope they start naming and shaming recalcitrant industry players on a regular basis from now on.
Realistically, how difficult do you think it will be to change the culture at APRA?
Well, there's nothing like a rocket in public from someone as well-respected as Graham Samuel to force change. So I think that APRA, particularly the way the report reveals a lot of the internal criticisms from staff and makes lots of very detailed recommendations, including about culture and staff practices and the fact that the three commissioners are all allocated a specific industry to be in charge of rather than having collective responsibility for the entire financial sector. I think all those recommendations are very good. And the fact that APRA has agreed to embrace all 19 of theirs and the government has agreed to embrace the 5 recommendations for the government, I think that means you will see significant reform, including legislation and more budget and a far more active and proactive and out there APRA going forward.
Speaking of the government, as you raised, do you think that they are serious enough to change a banking culture that's been around for so many years?
Well, they were serious enough to call a Royal Commission eventually into the banking sector. So I don't see why they wouldn't get into a bit of name and shame and getting into vetoing directors. The government knows there's no votes in protecting banks anymore, and so I think you'll see the government will take a pragmatic approach, which is the community wants tougher recommendations, a different culture. We've had some cowboy practices exposed. I don't see why there's any reason that the government shouldn't embrace these reforms and have a much tougher cop on the beat in APRA going forward, and I expect they'll do that.
One of the problems that the review has raised is that some employees of APRA have come from the banking sector and vice versa, causing a little bit of behind-the-scenes sort of stuff, allegedly. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I agree it is a problem of industry capture, and if you have too many ex-bankers working for the banking regulator, you run the risk of a regulator which is too sympathetic to the industry. So I think they should try and minimise the number of former bankers working at APRA and maybe have a few more law enforcement professionals, lawyers, regulators, more general business, former CFOs who've worked not in the bank themselves. But, you know, you do also have to have industry expertise, so you can't have a total ban on anyone who's worked for a bank, but you certainly shouldn't go straight from working for a bank to working for the regulator. There should be at least a decent cooling-off period of, like, 5 years before you can do that. So I think that is a problem, and I'm glad it's been outlined like this and will hopefully be addressed.
Stephen Mayne, journalist and shareholder activist, speaking with me about his thoughts on the release of the independent review into APRA.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
Imagine spending 5 years in a strange land without any contact with your loved ones. Then what's happening to... That's what's happening to thousands of refugees, and these are refugees within Australia. A report released today is intended to be a wake-up call to the government to consider the fates of these people. The Wire's Henry Wilson reports.
Today, the Australian Human Rights Commission released a report called Lives on Hold. It deals with a staggering 30,000 refugees and asylum seekers known as the legacy caseload, accepted into Australia 6 years ago, but increasingly left with almost no rights or support in the community. Australian Human Rights Commissioner Edward Santo explained who these people are.
All of them share one particular characteristic, and that is that they don't have clear long-term clarity about their visa situation here in Australia. So some of them have temporary visas, almost half of them are still waiting either for an initial decision or for an appeal process to play out. In the meantime, they're among the most vulnerable people in our community.
What prompted this report?
So we are conscious that a group that size, so 30,000 people, it'll take any government quite a long time to process our refugee application. So we've given the government some time, but we've also been hearing increasing reports from the community that this group of people are doing it particularly tough, and there are real strains on their basic human rights. And so what we did is we investigated those reports, and the fruit of that is our report, Lives on Hold.
Is Australia giving basic human rights to refugees, considering the treaties we are signed up to?
Well, I think Australia, in one sense, has a very proud history of helping people in need in lots of situations, including for refugees. And I don't think we should ever lose sight of that. But I also think we can do better and we need to do better. And this is a particular group of people who are very, very vulnerable, who many of them face the risk of poverty and homelessness. Many of them are at significant risk to their health, especially their mental health. And we have obligations under international human rights law to make sure that they're properly protected.
Edward Santo, Human Rights Commissioner. Marcella Brasser is a campaign manager at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, one of many community groups helping the refugees.
So most of the people that the ASRC supports is from this legacy caseload. So it's people who have various conditions on their bridging visas, people who haven't had work rights or study rights, people who are being cut off support services of the status resolution support services. And so people are quite vulnerable. They've been waiting for up to 8 years for an asylum outcome. If they are found to be refugees, they put on temporary protection visas with no family reunion and no pathway to permanent protection and resettlement. So people are, you know, it's been 8 years and people are, you know, deteriorating quite rapidly.
What are the ways in which your organisation can help these people?
We support them with frontline services. So we have health clinics, we've got a food bank, We cook lunch for people every day, dinner for people on Wednesdays. So we provide, you know, services to keep people from going hungry. We also provide emergency housing, emergency food packs. We do also have casework and a housing service, but it is stretched, like all of the organisations who look after people in this caseload. We are all stretched across Australia to the limit in having to provide emergency services now.
Marcella Brasek, campaign manager at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. I asked Edward Santo how he thinks the government will respond.
In one sense, we've been heartened by the fact that we've been able to meet with senior departmental officials and ministers as well. I'm very pleased that they've listened very carefully to what we've said. It's also fair to say that they haven't accepted all of our recommendations, at least not as yet. And so we hope that they'll continue to reflect on this. We're happy to work really practically and cooperatively with the government to try and reach a resolution, because there are some issues really that fundamentally just about making sure that people receive basic care, basic rights are protected. And there are some solutions there that are practical and relatively straightforward.
Your report makes 31 recommendations. Which one of those is most urgent?
I guess we're particularly worried about people being able to access medicine and not slipping into poverty if they become ineligible for a basic payment to help them with housing and so on. So for however long the continued processing takes place, we think it's really important that the government kind of makes sure that those basic needs are provided for, because that is an urgent need right now.
Human Rights Commissioner Edward Santo ending that story with The Wire's Henry Wilson. The situation across India, Nepal and Bangladesh is looking bad as the monsoon season rampages and causes mass floods across the area, with hundreds currently reported dead or missing. Oxfam's relief team has been quick to get on the scene and support people as the rivers continue to flood. Sri Bakhtar Baznet is in Nepal for Oxfam and described the situation to The Wire's Jack Padley.
Landslide and inundation in Nepal. Almost 32 districts have been affected because of this monsoon flood and landslide. And because of inundation, many people have been displaced from their home.
How many people have been displaced?
Around 385,000 population affected by flood and landslide. Out of them, around 96,300 people are displaced according to the data provided by the government. And these are the situations in Nepal. And at the moment, rain is stopped, but there is still rain, but the resulting rain is stopped since yesterday.
How much longer is the situation expected to go on for?
We cannot predict that soon will be normal, but the inundation problem is the big issue. Once the water is down, but their livelihood is gone, their livestock is gone, and the houses are damaged, and there is a lot of problem that we have to deal with situation.
What's the amount of casualties in Nepal right now?
77 people have been killed because of flood and landslide. Out of 77, 51 are male, 26 are women. Out of them, 40 are children.
What's the relief situation looking like in Nepal at the moment?
The government is on board together with community organization on the ground. And the government has mobilized secret forces for rescue work. And the rescue work is almost done. And displaced people have been given food by the local government and temporary shelter, tarpaulin seats, blankets, mattress are provided to the affected people by the government and the humanitarian organization as well. And Oxfam has been also responding to its implementing partner from the district, because Oxfam has been working in the district and we have mobilized our implementing partner and supporting in assessment, and we are also sending relief material to the district.
That was Sri Bakhtar Baznet, Oxfam Nepal's humanitarian manager, speaking to The Wire's Jack Padley. Australia has been hit by the flu this season with approximately 306 deaths from the virus and over 138,000 cases being reported. Flu shots are mandatory for people over 65 in aged care, and across the country, some preschools are now considering making the flu shot a condition of attendance. This raises the vaccination debate yet again. Dr. Margaret Heffernan's has received an Order of Australia for her research on public health education, in particular, Indigenous immunisation. She spoke to The Wire's Phoebe Christoffi on whether or not vaccinations should be mandatory.
Obviously, in our democratic society, we think we have a fundamental right to make a choice. However, I think we've also got a responsibility to think about our choice on others in our community. The United Nations Child UNICEF report has recently released a report that said that the global death rate of children under 5 years old from vaccine-related diseases has dropped by 41% since 1990 due to the increase of parents giving their children immunisation. And the World Health Organization has recently stated that the anti-vaccine movement is one of the top 10 health threats for 2019. So if all parents have trust in our system, I think they can really, you know, have massive benefits to their young children and keep them healthy. I'm constantly appalled at this group of people who, you know, expose their children. They'll have a measles party so the children can all get measles through, you know, spread of infection. Well, to me, that's a form of child abuse.
Institutions such as kindergartens are really coming down hard on not admitting children who have not been vaccinated. So do you think this alienation will motivate parents to change their minds regarding vaccinations?
Well, I'm not sure that I see it as alienation. Now, if parents have knowingly not immunised their children and are at risk of, say, getting one of the childhood diseases of whooping cough, measles, mumps, chickenpox that are rampant at the moment and are easily protected through vaccination, then as a parent, I'd be concerned about the risk to my child. And so, therefore, why do some people think that they've got the sense of entitlement to deliberately not vaccinate their child with what is a very, very safe vaccine based on their view?
Going off of your point of the responsibilities of people taking the vaccine, flu season has peaked early this year, yet there are opportunities in the private health sector to get free vaccines. Should the government provide free vaccines for public health?
Yes, absolutely. I think when you look at the cost to hospitals, medical clinics, society in general, I think the subsidy that the government would be spending would be far, far less than the overall cost of having to treat these sick individuals.
I'm also aware that some of your research has been specifically on Aboriginal programs. Can you please elaborate on what this means for Indigenous communities?
Yes, I've done quite a bit of work with Indigenous communities around the human papillomavirus vaccine in Central Australia and also Victoria. So what we did was we shared all the information that we knew scientifically about the vaccine. The communities then led the approach. So it was with the Aboriginal health workers, the Aboriginal medical service and other health professions in each community and region. And they said, this is the best way for us. And so it was around Indigenous artwork, it was Indigenous resources. We trained the Aboriginal health workers in the facts about it, who then did the most brilliant job in educating all their communities through their particular health programs. As a result of that community-led approach, in the Northern Territory particularly, they now have the highest uptake of HPV vaccination in girls and boys in the world, which is absolutely fabulous success. And it's because the Indigenous communities knew it was an important vaccine to keep their peoples healthy. They were willing to accept the scientific evidence. They also put in the resources that were culturally appropriate for each of their communities. They developed them and trained them.
Dr. Margaret Heffernan speaking with The Wire's Phoebe Christoffi on the importance of vaccinations. Now, we hardly think of tattoo parlours as places of therapy, but one woman in Adelaide is changing that. Artist Alicia Gannon is putting her tattoo skills to work to create new nipples for women who have lost their breasts to cancer. By shining light on the body image issues women encounter after battling cancer, Gannon shows that the journey after treatment can sometimes be just as complicated. Alicia came to The Wire studio today and spoke to Annie Hastwell.
What they're given with after post-mastectomy surgery is sometimes they can keep a nipple, or sometimes they have to take the entire nipple off, so they're left with flat lumps, usually with a scar across it.
What are you able to offer a woman like that who's post-mastectomy, who's having big issues with their body image?
I have a few options. I have temporary options. So if they're still going through radiation or chemotherapy after their surgery, these are just temporary options to put on them, which last about 10 days, and they give the effect of a 3D nipple. So we have some soft pink ones, some latte colour nipples, darker nipples. We've got some heart nipples as well.
And they just stick on?
They just stick on, very similar to temporary tattoos that you put on children.
But they're 3D, so from a distance it looks exactly like you have a nipple.
Yes, and I've got a special product that you put over it and it takes that shine away and it helps it to last around nearly 2 weeks.
So what made you start doing this?
I do 3D permanent nipples as well. I tattoo them on women. But a lot of the women, they said, no, we don't. We're actually not ready for any tattooing because our immune system's still down. So we actually can't have tattooing done. And I thought, what other options can these women have that I can help? So I started doing my research and the temporary nipples were the next best thing. So they don't have anything like that in Australia yet. They've got it overseas in a few countries, but Australia, there was a massive need for it.
And you also cover up scars by using tattoos.
Yeah, some women, they've got scars all around their breasts and around their armpits. It's in areas that they don't want to be reminded of what they've just been through. So I offer scar cover-up with usually flowers or hummingbirds or butterflies, something beautiful.
So in this case, it's almost like a rebirth.
Yeah, definitely. It really, I've noticed a big change in the women once I've tattooed their nipples on. With everything they've gone through, they come in as broken women, but they leave feeling amazing. And that's probably the best part of my job, is I get to recreate that self-confidence and I can see it in their face and they're just so happy. And I sometimes cry with them when I've done the procedure.
You must have some very interesting conversations while this is going on.
Very interesting.
You must get quite an insight into all the traumas that happen after.
Definitely. There are so many repercussions from a woman going through breast cancer. It's unbelievable. And it doesn't just affect women over 50. It affects a lot of women from 20 onwards.
So can you give me a little bit of an insight into the psychological issues that there are for women, apart from just hating to look at their bodies?
Some women that I've had as clients, they've been single women and they've either been single before or during, and some of their partners haven't actually felt comfortable dealing with their breast cancer journey with them. And so not only have they lost their partner, but they actually lose their breasts and their self-identity as a woman. So for me to recreate that and to give that confidence back to them is amazing, because then that gives them that step to go out into the world and meet a new partner. And that's important. We all want to have a partner and feel loved, and to have that self-identity as a woman taken away with breast cancer, putting it back on really gives them that sense of belonging.
You know, you're running a business. How do you find the women and let them know that this is available?
I find it very difficult because social media doesn't, Facebook and Instagram don't allow me as much to get too much out there because of the nudity. But I've reached out to local companies, hospitals and surgeries to try and get more of this out there.
So what kind of restrictions do you come across with Facebook? Because recently there was that fuss about the breast cancer poster that Facebook took down because it showed women with breasts that had been disfigured.
I've actually been affected a lot by Facebook and Instagram. I've been deleted off Facebook and Instagram a few times and blocked. They say that they allow post-mastectomy photos, but they actually don't. So that's a big, that's a big challenge. So I try to only put up a few things every now and then and focus on my website.
So women have to, it has to be word of mouth, really.
It has to be word of mouth.
It must be very rewarding kind of work to do.
It's the reason why I'm doing this and the reason why I'm here in my life. I love it.
But you would have loved tattooing before this.
I did. I'm an artist, so I love any form of artwork, and I used to do special effects before that. But doing this, really, I feel like I've got a purpose in life, and it makes me really happy to help other women.
And why would a woman need to do this, the stick-on temporary tattoo rather than get you to do a permanent tattoo?
Sometimes women aren't ready for tattooing. Sometimes they don't want to be tattooed. Sometimes they don't know if they want to do another procedure and if they're comfortable. But usually 9 out of 10, after putting on temporary nipples, they say, you know what, I feel beautiful again, I'm going to do this. No nipples are the same, but I do also do custom nipples. So if a woman has only had one breast removed, I can customise the other one and create it for them.
Has it changed you?
It's definitely changed me as a person. It's made me a lot more knowledgeable about what can actually happen, a lot more emotional towards this journey, a journey which fortunately I haven't actually experienced myself, but I know a lot of people around me have. So for me to get involved with this, it makes me feel really happy that I can help someone.
Alicia Gannon from Pink Lotus Breast Restoration speaking to The Wire's Annie Hastwell. And that's all for The Wire today. Catch us same time tomorrow on your local station. Today's show came from the studios of Radio Adelaide. I'm Oliver Brown. Thanks for your company.